Well, thank you, Barbara. I'd like to thank you very much for the invitation and introduction. I'm, of course, very, very pleased with the honor. So it's like most of us don't feel it is deserved, but in any case, more than willing to accept. So, this is, okay. So what I'd like to talk about is some developments that have taken place over a number of years in stochastic analysis that are motivated by problems of modeling evolving populations. This is, of course, an enormously wide and rich area. By evolving population, we mean a finite population of individuals who have multi-type individuals, possibly, as I'll discuss, even infinitely many types, that reproduce at random, and they may have random or systematic modifications. The offspring may be different than the parents. Well, these arise in, of course, traditionally evolutionary biology and molecular biology. In more recent years, they also play a role in evolutionary economics. I mean, there's a school of thought in economics today that deviates from the classical picture, of which was based on many very strong assumptions, which involve some behavioral aspects, and their evolutionary ideas are playing a role. And also in evolutionary computation, methods, stochastic methods for search and optimization are also based on these evolutionary concepts. So the basic problem is to describe the evolution of the population structure and the genealogy in a complex environment. So, as I'll emphasize mostly in this lecture, that, of course, what makes an evolving system different than a system in physics is the structure, the family structure, the fact that individuals are related. And there are different questions that arise in the different subfields. In evolutionary biology, of course, at the present, there's an enormous amount of work going on in how you use population data to reconstruct evolutionary history, and they're based on models, and those models will be the ones I'll describe. In evolutionary computation, you would like to look at population-based search and optimization algorithms and how to design an algorithm to take the greatest advantage of the ideas that are inspired by population biology. And then finally, the, of course, much more complex areas of ecology, where you have to study multi-species with a coevolution, and the question is how to really understand, that's the final objective of all this, to really understand how populations develop complex structures by interaction in a random complex environment. Well, I'll sort of start with an outline of which I won't be able to go through the whole thing. I'll start with the very classical models, which go back to the 19th century, and then look successively at analytical methods, large population limits, which involve various kinds of limit theorems. And then the central part of the talk, I'd like to talk about infinitely many types models, how we model genealogy and history, and one of the themes will be that there's sort of simultaneously an analytical structure and a combinatorial structure to the study of these things. And then part of this work is motivated by ideas from statistical physics. So statistical physics has developed a large number of very powerful ideas that have some potential ramifications for evolutionary models. And this will involve things related to the renormalization group methods of statistical physics, idea of universality classes. This is a huge area which I'll probably not really have time to get into it all. Excuse me, I just need a little bit of water. Well, I have some here, I think. Oh, no, I got it. Sorry. Malt-Vec. Okay, so I'll start at the very beginning. The classical model is going back to the 19th century. So the first model was the Galton-Watson process. The Galton-Watson process is simply a process where in time a population, individuals give either die with some death rate D, or they give rise to an offspring, birth rate B. And then associated to this, you can describe this simple process in terms of a Markov semigroup, which is an analytical object, which is just simply defined a semigroup of operators on bounded functions on Z plus, which is simply given by this formula where you look at the conditional expected value of F at the state of the system at time t, conditioned on the initial state psi 0. And this is, of course, a very trivial example where one can apply the Hale-Yoshida theorem to prove that this, even though it's an unbounded operator, has generated a semigroup. The other side to the picture, of course, is that if you start with three individuals, well, this one may die without ever producing offspring, and this one produces some family of offspring over a period of time. And we would like to look at both sides of this and connect the analytical and the combinatorial. Well, one very basic property of Galton-Watson processes is if the mean, okay, that's the difference between the birth and death rates, is non-zero, then we just simply have exponential. The mean, it just goes exponentially, increases or goes to zero. But if m equals zero, it's the expected value is a constant, but then the population size is a martingale and goes to extinction with probability 1. So therefore, Galton-Watson process, even though rather interesting and intriguing, has the property always goes to extinction or unbounded growth. Of course, from reality, that's not a very natural way to model a population. And traditionally, of course, the model that was then produced was to look at a supercritical process, but where there's a competition for finite resources. So then you would get the classical Verhulst equation, where you have a finite carrying capacity, like a stable equilibrium. Okay, well, in population genetics, they looked what to do, because we're interested in the structure of populations. So essentially, the classical, or even up to modern population genetics, is based on models in which you assume you have a sequence of generations of constant size. So essentially, say we have a finite carrying capacity. Let's, for example, assume that each generation, again, we produce the same number of offspring. But what will be studied will be the types. So here we look at a situation where there are K-types of individuals, where we always have K-types. And then the basic mechanism studied in population genetics is this notion of multinomial sampling. So that would say if at generation N, you had X1 of type 1 and so on, down to XK of type K, then at generation N plus 1, you'll pick a multinomial sample from the empirical distribution at the nth generation. If you like, sometimes pictorially we say this, individuals pick their parents at random from the previous generation. And then in addition, of course, we may assume that there's a small mutation rate, so an individual may differ in type from the parent. And so this is just, again, a little picture. In this case, we had five individuals, only two were lucky enough to produce offspring that survived in the following generation. Okay, so we want to introduce both analytical tools and combinatorial tools. So the first basic, so what we want to do is we want to look at problems where the finite population effect is important. Of course, if you look at infinite population cases, you get deterministic equations and system of ordinary differential equations to describe the behavior of a population. But if you want to include the effect of finite population effects, one goes a bit beyond the ODE limit, and you look at the diffusion process limit, which here I explain both cases. For Galton-Watson, if you assume you're near criticality, so you have a mean which is close to one, for example, then you can rescale. You look at the population with n individuals, you assign mass 1 over n to each individual, and with this slow rate of change between the births and the deaths, you can speed it up and you get, in the limit, a stochastic process, which is the solution of a stochastic differential equation. This is, here W is just a standard Brownian motion. In the case of the Roit-Fisher, you can do the same thing. There you have a probability vector. Well, here we look at the numbers over n. So we have a probability vector. And so these approximating things are then just processes with values in the simplex. And then the limit of this process, as n goes to infinity, is a diffusion process with a second order generator, which is already something rather interesting and has been studied a lot in its own terms. Even questions of closely related processes to this, questions of actually proving that these generate semigroups, are quite non-trivial. And here there's sort of a parameter, which is sort of the relative effect of the relative strength of mutation versus the finite population sampling, which is this gamma. So if you think gamma goes to 0 would be the infinite population limit. Okay, so my first question now is, where is the family structure? When we take that diffusion limit, we get a nice process, we get a semigroup, maybe a solution of a stochastic differential equation, but at first sight it appears that all that family structure has disappeared. So to kind of recapture and understand how to study family structure, genealogy, and so on, in the continuum context, we have to move, first of all, the basic tool is to move to potentially infinite type systems. For example, we want potentially an infinite number of genotypes, phenotypes, or genealogies. So we'll now put a space which we take 0, 1, it's just a label. So we want potentially an infinite number of types. So we'll label it for the moment 0, 1. And then the state space for the probability distribution of types will simply be a probability. This is simply the space of probability measures on E. So here I just sketched how to construct one simple example. If you partition the unit interval into a finite number of pieces, and then you just assume that each one of those is a type, and you look at the finite K-type Roit-Fisher diffusion with type-independent mutation, where when a mutation occurs, you'll pick the type just according to the Levay measure of that subset. And it's very easy to show that if we then take a finer partition and look at that process, but we only look at the restriction to the process giving the masses of the rougher partition, then they're consistent. So you can take a projective limit and construct a process which is then N1 of 0, 1 valued. And this is turned out to be a very important process called the infinitely many alleles Fleming-Veil process. Well, the analytical tool for studying these, well, we saw originally we worked with stochastic differential equations or semigroups. It turns out to work at this level, there's large advantage and in some cases necessity to reformulate things rather in terms of what's known as the martingale problem. So martingale problem, the process is going to be something which you describe probability law of the set of possible trajectories in M1 of E. And what the martingale problem does is simply to characterize the probability law in terms of some statements. And the statements are that for every phi, in this case in C of E, that these objects are martingales, which are of course very natural mathematical objects, where here this simply means the integral, and Q is the generator of a mutation semigroup. So it turns out that this defines, one can prove existence uniqueness, that for every mutation operator, there in fact exists a process. In the special case of the type independent mutation for the infinitely many alleles model, it's this very simple operator. Well, there's a modification of this, or a variation of this, which is very important in the analysis of DNA sequence data. And that's our type space now will be 0, 1 to the Z plus. And so, and the mutation operator is going to be this. So what it really says, I'm going to define my states will be sequences, well, almost surely finite, so there'll be only finitely many non-zero points. And when a mutation takes place, we'll choose the point C between 0 and 1, just according to the uniform measure. And then we'll shift this and put the C in the first position. And the interpretation will simply be that these are going to be the sites at which successive mutations occur. So X1 will be the site of the most recent mutation, X2 site of second most recent mutation, and so on. And this is used in the analysis of DNA sequence data. For example, if you have these two things, we can pick out, well, these two individuals had a common ancestor which had mutations at these points. And after they last broke off from the common ancestor, one of them had mutations at these points and one had mutations here. And I should just emphasize that because we always pick a new type with a uniform distribution on 0, 1, we never get the same type. So every time a mutation occurs, we get a different type, or a different, in this case, a different site on the DNA strain where the mutation will occur. Of course, that's very natural. It's very unlikely that you get a reverse mutation that cancels out a previous mutation when you have an extremely long DNA string. Okay. So one of the remarkable results, very simple but very important idea that's will play a big role in what I'd like to discuss, is how to reconstruct the family structure in the setting, in the continuum setting. And this is the following observation, that we can actually get a representation for continuum probability measure, from using a countable set of points. And this is so-called Donnelly-Kurtz representations of Fleming-Veo. And I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to put the picture up instead of the words, and I'll explain it as follows. So this is just what I'm putting down here is the countable particle representation of that infinitely many alleles. Well, not quite, because I only had a few colors. But in any case, the particle system is as follows. You take this thing on the vertical axis, you place an infinite number of particles at time. And now what the particles do is, at some rate, they jump down. They never jump up, they simply jump down. So this particle, for example, jumps down here, and so. So the exact dynamics is that every particle has a constant rate to jump down to every one of the particles below it. So as you go up here, the rate of jumping down gets bigger and bigger, and in fact it's very easy to show that after any positive epsilon time, they've all jumped down to some finite level. And, well, and then these colors represent mutations. So we started with wave, and then this goes back to the last common ancestor. So we have some initial type, but then there were mutations. So these are the various mutations. And that then gives rise to the second basic object, which, oh, sorry. So let me, before I do that, just mention then the theorem. The theorem is that we can reconstruct the probability measure value process simply by taking the limiting relative frequencies of types of that countable particle system. So this gives us a very, very explicit way of describing this system. And then for the analysis of genetic data, something which comes immediately from that, Kingman's coalescent, is if we look at the particle system backward in time, it gives us a coalescing system, and this produces the genealogical tree of the population. So that's this picture. So that's just taken from the previous look-down process and just looking at the last look-downs. So that then gives us the genealogy plus the various mutations that have taken place. Well, the first consequence is it's a very, very simple picture, but it's surprising when from that very simple picture one can deduce a number of rather interesting, very explicit results. First result is that the infinitely many alleles measure on 0-1 is purely atomic. So that means there's only a countable number of types. And that dynamics has an invariant probability measure. And for that invariant probability measure, we can describe explicitly in one of two equivalent ways the distribution of the atoms. One is if we order the atoms according to size, it's something called the Poisson-Dirichlet distribution, which is a projective limit of Dirichlet distributions. And then there's size biasing, which means I would take that and then I'd pick one using the empirical probabilities, and then I get the so-called gem representation, which is, gives explicitly the probability sequence, the probability weights, just in terms of an IID sequence of beta random variables. So this is a very explicit representation where you can then use this to deduce many things. And sort of interesting that this Poisson-Dirichlet or GEM also arise in combinatorics and also in number theory. So it's a rather important, I think, but very simple and basic mathematical object. Okay, well, that's very nice. But of course, if we want to really understand the evolution of populations are also distributed in space. And so the question is how to study populations where at each, well, what I've done here is, for example, we have some we're using discrete space here for various historical reasons, was introduced by Maleko. There's something called the stepping stone model, where you sort of simplify geography by simply assuming that there's some set of sites, and you have population of each one of these sites, which is sort of undergoing that, well, we can have infinitely many types, evolution with mutation and finite population sampling, and also migration of individuals between the sites. And for the set of sites, we take a countable abelian group. That's not absolutely essential, but in any way, then we can do some calculations using harmonic analysis. And we assume that the migration process satisfies some kind of semi-group on the set of sites. And at each site, then there's some local stochastic dynamics. So that's essentially a spatially distributed system. And now there are a number of questions that we want to address. So the first questions we want to address, the evolution of, well, we're of course interested in the entire structure of the population, but we could ask, what is the evolution of the spatial structure as time evolves? We could ask questions about the existence and structure of equilibria, and maybe one of the most interesting questions, breakdown of spatial homogeneity and the formation of non-equilibrium structures. So what are the strategies for looking at these questions? So there are two strategies. One strategy, so we have this population distributed in space with infinitely many types. One strategy is to a variation on that coalescent look-down type process I described earlier. We can look at this spatially structured coalescent, which sort of describes the ancestral history of the population, not only in terms of what types they were, but also where they were located on this set of sites S. So I call this the bottom-up approach, because we normally, in doing this, we start with one individual and then we identify all the various relatives of that individual and when they broke off from the common family tree. The other approach is what I call the top-down approach, which is in some sense more in the spirit of statistical physics, which says I'm going to look at block averages. So I'm going to look at averages over a block. Well, BK is just going to be a ball of radius K. And then we're going to take the average over the balls of radius K. And then the idea is to look at these averages over blocks, but also in various timescales. So we're going to look at the block, the average over a block of radius K in timescales, which will be informed the number of points in BK raised to some power. The power will be chosen. It's going to be chosen in a variety of ways, depending on what we want to answer. So those are the two basic ideas. So let's give two explicit examples just to kind of get a sense of it. So the first example is super random walk. That'll be a system, a countable system of stochastic differential equations, one for each site, S. We'll assume at each site, each of the population is just non-negative real, which gives the mass of population of that site, and there, locally, it will satisfy this continuous state branching mechanism. And between sites, there'll be migration according to the kernel Q. And here, of course, the Brownian motions are assumed to be a system of independent Brownian motions. Now, what's nice about that particular system is that one can do explicit calculations using of distributions using the Laplace functional, which is this set of things, if I vary C, completely characterizes the spatial distribution at time t, and that's given in terms of something which we can compute using this deterministic nonlinear evolution equation. Well, the second case I want to mention for future reference is what I'll call a generalized Wright-Fisher stepping stone model, which again will be the same kind of migration mechanism, but at each site there will be, again, we'll assume that it's going to take values between 0 and 1. This will represent the proportion of the population at site C of a particular type. And the classical case, g of x equals x1 minus x, corresponds to the Wright-Fisher model. But we're going to look at this for general g, which is, should be 0 at the endpoints and positive in the interior, plus some regularity that I won't really mention, very weak regularity. Okay, so maybe the most basic model is the one I guess I drew in the picture a little bit earlier, the infinite many allele stepping stone. So what we have here is going to be at each site in the countable abelian group S, we will have a probability measure which represents the distribution of types in the population at that site at a given time. And we'll assume that you have these various local dynamics, that finite population sampling mechanism, possibly mutation at rate C, and also, of course, migration between sites. So the combinatorial object here is this is a very, very powerful thing, very nice, which I call the Shigenoda-Harrod-Takahata coalescent process. So it's going to characterize, it's going to allow us to calculate pretty much in an explicit way things about that population in terms of the following combinatorial objects. So for we start with an N. This is for any N, we will have this object. And at time T, this thing will give us a partition of the of 1 to N into K subsets. And this second ingredient will give us the location of the partition element. And the process evolves in the following very, very simple way. Partition elements, see how these partition elements, they perform independent continuous time random walks with these rates. If there's mutation, with state-independent mutation, we will actually be able to do something nice and simple. We will allow a partition element to jump to a specific point infinity, which we denote by infinity, at rate C. And that site will sort of hold the mutation source distribution. What I've written down before would just be, at that site you'll have a measure, which is this uniform measure in 0, 1. And again, the partition elements, the partition elements are going to be moving according to these random walks. When two partition elements are at the same site, they can coalesce. So the two partition elements will now coalesce to form one partition element containing the points in either of them. So once again, of course, if there are a lot of partition elements, that will happen quickly. And recently, in some very nice work, which is, I guess, not yet published, by Grevin, Linick, and Winter, they extended this to the infinite lookdown process. So you would have initially at every site countably many points, and eventually this countable set of points will give you a complete description of the entire population structure. So what we're interested in is then using this, as it's a very basic tool, to describe what happens on long time scales to the structure of the population. So the point is that it depends very strongly on the nature of the random walks. So we introduce, first question is if the random walk is transient or recurrent, that's the most crucial dichotomy from this point of view. And of course, transient simply can be written either analytically or probabilistically, simply saying that that there's a last exit time from a ball of radius r with probability 1. And to study more delicate properties of the behavior of these systems, we have to introduce the notion of degree of transience, which will say, well, transience just simply says that LBR is finite almost surely, but the degree of transience is going to be the soup of the set of zeta such that the zetath moment of the last exit time is finite. So it's sort of a measure of how strongly transient it is. We'll call it strong transience if gamma is equal to or greater than 1, saying that there's at least a first moment for the last exit time. And, well, I guess it's the next slide. So just to get a feeling for that, for nearest neighbor random walk on ZD, well, we know of its classical result that it's transient if and only if D is bigger than 2. And in that case, the gamma degree of transience is D over 2 minus 1. Okay, so one of the basic tools that we're attempting to use to study these questions is to replace, well, of course, you could replace the S, ZD is sort of a natural thing for various reasons, but Sawyer and Felsenstein introduced a space, a group, which we call the hierarchical group, here is an integer, and it's a countable abelian group where we just simply take strings again from 0 to n minus 1, where all the finitely many are zeros, with addition modulo, component-wise addition modulo n. And then the idea here is it's a model of a hierarchical space. So here we'll define this distance as simply, we'll view this as a hierarchical distance. So the distance, those elements distance 0 will be considered, well, of course, that's just one individual, but those distance 1 will be, if you like, in the same at the same site, individual same site. Distance 2 will be, say, in the same group, same village, region, and so on. So we're thinking of sort of a hierarchy of scales of space. And then the random walks that we look at on these spaces have a very simple structure. We'll simply define what is the rate of jumping k levels in the hierarchy. And then once we decide to jump k levels in the hierarchy, we'll pick a point in a ball of that radius, radius k, uniformly. So it's a rather nice, and here we can, the random walk is transient if and only if some 1 over cj is finite. And the point is that for potential theoretic reasons, one can sort of think of this as sort of a canonical example of when the, for example, when the decay of the Green's function has some property. So this is rather a, it's a caricature in some sense, but it turns out to be a rather useful way of thinking about things. And it also, well, our approach is then to study this when n goes to infinity. So this will give us a kind of infinite refinement of the mean field method, which is a very powerful method in statistical physics. Okay, so the coming to back to the infinitely many alleles model on a countable abelian group. So it turns out that long-term coexistence, so you could ask, if I just look at a single site and I look at after a long period of time, will I see only one type, or will I see potentially infinitely many types? So long-term coexistence of types means that there's going to be an equilibrium measure which contains at each site a multiplicity of types. Well, that will be true if and only if the random mutation random walk is transient. So that's sort of the first basic dichotomy. And then secondly, one can look a bit further. So we could actually describe using that coalescent look-down structure, we can describe very explicitly the population structure. Namely, so we're going to look at a situation where there is an equilibrium, so that means that we have an infinite population whose mean is spatially translation invariant, and the population can be decomposed into a countable set, a countable family of submeasures, where each, for each I, the submeasure, this is a, if you think this is an infinite measure, of course locally finite, but infinite measure, which has also zero spatial density. So if, in other words, if you look at the amount of mass in a ball of radius k, you divide by the volume of the box and go to infinity, it goes to zero. So it's in some sense a small part of the measure. And so this gives us, we call these the immortal plan decomposition of the equilibrium state. And what the interpretation is, this is the set of, we've decomposed the entire population into families that go back to a common ancestor. So there's sort of, if you like, countably many common ancestors that, and of course, if you actually think about this, you trace back, if you go back further and further in time, those common ancestors came from further and further away, because all individuals that started in any compact or bounded set eventually die out. So it's a rather interesting structure, and maybe more for mathematical interest than for biological interest, but I think even there, there's some point that this gives some information. We could also ask, what is the probability that the infinite family revisits the origin? So we have this infinite family, and we could, there are two possibilities. If we look at a ball, maybe that infinite family eventually never visits the ball again. We call that recurrence, or transience, or it comes back and recurs. And it turns out that for that, the Clan transience recurrence dichotomy is degree of transience should be 1, which is in the nearest neighbor random walk case would be 4 dimensions. So in 4 dimensions, if we lived in 4 dimensions, these infinite families would revisit. Otherwise, we will not see at some point or other some group of individuals that live forever, but they'll never visit our local area. Well, these questions, and what I'll discuss, I think, briefly now, is can be done rather generally, but some very beautiful work that's been done over the last 10 or so years by Cox, Durrett, and Perkins, and then Bramson, Cox, and Legall, and also some work of myself with Andreas Greven, suggests that there's an object which is we call a self-similar super Brownian clan, which describes the large-scale structure of these immortal clans in a very large universality class. And, well, I will just very briefly explain what that is. So, first of all, that comes from looking at the super Brownian motion comes from looking at the continuum limit of that system of stochastic differential equations, where now, of course, we're just taking the nearest neighbor random walk, and on a lattice, epsilon ZD with the usual kind of speeding up that would then give for ordinary, in the deterministic case, we converge to the heat equation. And now if we do this in a setting where we have at each site, we also have this continuous state branching, in the limit, we get a process, which is now, of course, going to be a process. Well, this is starting with just finite total measure at this stage. So we then have a process which is going to be a continuous trajectory into the space of finite measures on RD, which is called super Brownian motion. And the whole question of these spatial things, of course, is quite a big subject. But in that particular case, if we look in one dimension, it turns out it corresponds to the solution of a stochastic partial differential equation, which is this one. And, of course, even this equation is somewhat difficult to work with rigorously. There's open questions even about the strong uniqueness of this equation. And in higher dimensions, it turns out that the object that results is a singular measure and doesn't have a density, so there's really no natural stochastic partial differential equation that occurs. So it turns out that if you look at this and you assume it at time zero, you start with a uniform measure, then again the population breaks down in the transient case, has an equilibrium, where again you can decompose the population into these countable number of subpopulations, and each one of them is a very interesting object which is a self-similar measure. And it's that self-similar measure that seems to be sort of a kind of a universal point that other things should converge to. And the results I mentioned of Cox, Durrett, and Perkins, and so on, are rigorous results where these things have been proved. Well, if we try, by the way, just a curiosity maybe, this stage, if we try to do the same thing with the Wright-Fishers, well, in one dimension, again, you would get a stochastic PDE, which is a good study. But if you look at two or higher dimensions, actually, this actually goes to a deterministic thing. It says somehow this is not quite the right way to look. It's not a meaningful, really, kind of limit process for the Wright-Fishers. Okay, so these results that I mentioned were obtained because we have this very explicit way. We have this nice combinatorial object we can compute. It's quite easy to compute with. We can get many results. But of course, that if you make almost any perturbation you can think of, the methods that were used to get all these nice results disappear. I mean, you can't do anything. So I've been interested, together with Andreas Greven, in this question. Intuitively, this should be true much more generally. This population structure is something very natural, universal, and if there's some state-dependent branching rates or mutation rates or something, it shouldn't really matter. So the idea is how to approach the question of robustness and universality. Well, here we use the top-down approach. Now, I think realistically, I'm not going to be able to explain the details very much. I'll sort of just try to paint the picture. So the idea is we have this multi-scale thing. We're looking at a sequence of scales where, actually maybe things are going up. And what happens if you look at these block averages in time scales, if you look at, say, the jth time scale, where this is going, the jth time scale is basically a little faster than n to the j, then those things, the block averages from k less than j, they form equilibria. So there's a sequence, a hierarchy of what we call quasi-equilibria. And then one can let j go to infinity, and then you get, well, the question is, when, so, and this forms, that sequence of pictures at the different scales forms a Markov chain in this limit. Using this hierarchical mean field limit, which is letting n go to infinity, you get a Markov chain. And then the question is, does the Markov chain have an entrance law? And it turns out, well, I got a little bit ahead of myself because just to mention that these Markov chains have very nice transition functions, which are either gamma distributions or beta distributions. So again, these are very nice canonical objects. And it turns out that an entrance law does exist if and only if, well, this is sort of what we expect, if and only if the summation 1 over Cj is finite, which means that we're in the transient case. And in fact, the results are such that we can prove that this Markov chain, which we now get explicitly in the entrance law, describes the large-scale behavior of these objects when n is big. So in other words, we can actually look at the block averages on the when n is finite, which means on these hierarchical groups, and that the structure of the successive levels of the block averages converge to this object. So it's somehow giving us information about the picture. Okay, I'm not got much time left, but let me just say just a little bit more. So when we do this, and this is done just in the very simplest case, say if either this is the generalized Wright-Fisher, if we do that, then it turns out, of course, in the Wright-Fisher case, when we do this, we get a sequence of Wright-Fishers. So at every scale, the picture is a Wright-Fisher. But when we start here with a generalized Wright-Fisher, we get, at each level, we get a new function. The functions are derived in some coming from some integral. And then the question is, what are the fixed points? So it's a nonlinear integral equation, and the fixed points will correspond to the universality classes. And let me just end with that. So essentially, it turns out that it's really quite surprising how complete the results are, at least in... Okay, so the results here are, if we look at generalized Wright-Fisher, with some extremely weak conditions on the G, and then we do the iterations, those things converge to Wright-Fisher. So it's a universality class which has a very strong domain of attraction. In the same case, well, I didn't mention Anderson, so let's just look at the Feller. When G is, the support of G is the open interval 0 infinity, then similarly one can prove under somewhat, well, you have to assume some conditions on the growth rate at infinity of G. Once again, the iterates of these things converge. And I guess what we're playing with these days, of course, this is the case where you just have one-dimensional objects. But if you look at higher dimensional objects, the questions become very much harder. And we introduce family of something called catalytic and mutually catalytic, which are additional fixed points that occur in two dimensions. So I guess just to conclude, what I'd like to mention, or just to emphasize, my feeling is that this is really a subject which has sort of just barely begun to be studied, because I think this question of how you really understand the development of complex populations in complex environments is a very exciting and difficult problem. And, well, the tools that are produced here are, of course, just in some sense limited to certain types of questions, but on the other hand, they're rather powerful. And now using these tools, I mean, now the current work is largely involved with things related to, of course, I didn't mention selection or recombination here at all, which are important mechanisms in evolutionary biology, but one can extend these at least one is making attempts to extend these to these more complex things and to use this sort of as a tool to really gain some understanding, hopefully in the longer run, of what it is that, you know, creates the diverse population just from these simple multi-types with these various kinds of interactions. Okay, thank you.